And now to Ron Rash. He's one of the bards of his home state, North Carolina, directing an unflinching gaze at poverty and drug addiction, while also giving lyrical voice to the beauty of the Appalachians.
Though sunlight tinges the mountains, black leather-winged bodies swing low. First fireflies blink languidly. Beyond this meadow, cicadas rev and slow like sewing machines. All else ready for night except night itself.
Cicadas like sewing machines. That's Ron Rash reading from his new novel, Above the Waterfall. The waterfall, one that cascades through an upscale fishing resort that's failed to elevate the fortunes of the town around it. The story is told from two points of view: Becky, a ranger in a state park escaping a violent past, and Les, the town sheriff, consumed by his town's crystal meth addictions. And soon he'll have even more to contend with. The water at the resort is poisoned, killing the main draw, the fish. The investigation that follows will bring up painful memories for both Les and Becky. Again, the book is Above the Waterfall, and Ron Rash joins us from Clemson University. Ron, nice to speak with you again.
Good to talk to you as well, Robin. And that's a real upbeat introduction, yeah. Isn't it?
Well, you know, let's ask you about the crystal meth addictions.
Yeah.
You know, as I was reading, it's such a contrast between the beauty of the area and the ravaging of the crystal meth. But I found myself thinking, well, wait a second, hasn't your area moved on to heroin like the rest of the country?
Well, unfortunately, Oxycontin and heroin are a problem, but meth remains a pretty serious problem. I mean, every time I look in the newspaper, there's been an arrest, usually several.
Yeah. Well, I'd love to hear another reading from you, because until you hear the real descriptions, and we talked to an emergency room doctor in Tennessee, the entire emergency room turned over to treating crystal meth. It's just one of the ugliest addictions, if you can make that characterization. You write about how your character, Les, the sheriff, is making yet another bust with his people. It's a small town, and he knows who this girl is that he's going to find. Do you mind reading for us his thoughts when he makes that bust?
Jarvis cuffed Rodney Greer and sat him on the couch where Ben Lindsay's daughter was passed out. She wore a green halter top and a pair of maroon sweatpants, no shoes. Every other toenail was painted black like piano keys. A thin line of drool ran down the right side of her mouth. Television glamorized meth, even when they tried not to. You didn't smell the moldy food or the vomit or blood. The meth itself burning your nose like ammonia. Or how, once you'd arrested them, you turned your face so you didn't smell their rotting mouths. No, TV couldn't give you that.
Yeah, Ron Rash, how do you know about this?
Have
you, have you gone on raids? Have you, you know?
Actually, a friend of mine who's a sheriff has, and in a sense, he was my resource for this, and he has seen it, and it's, as you say, it's been devastating. I'm hoping it's starting to end in this, I would hope, the whole United States. I hope it's going to burn itself out.
I'm wondering if your friend also told you there's a moment where Les and his deputies are just seized with fear because they realize there's a baby missing, and they all glance toward the microwave and think the worst. Now, we should say it isn't the worst.
No.
But he quits right on the spot. I mean, have you heard those stories?
I've heard some interesting stories. As a matter of fact, one of my students' father was a detective and would actually go on these raids. And she said at night, and I actually use this in the novel, he would get up in the middle of the night and start vacuuming the house.
Hmm.
And I just thought that was so emblematic of the effect. And one thing that is very important to me is my chief interest is more in the people who are innocent, the children and the parents. Those are the people that I want to focus on so that I don't sensationalize it.
Well, and against this, you paint a picture of the most idyllic landscape. The birds, you know, the bird calls, you know, the names of the flowers, or your character does. Where is that you being channeled in some cases through Becky, the ranger? Or did you have to go out and research that as well? You know, what's the name of that darn thing?
Yeah. Well, I've got friends who are botanists, and I always give them a free copy of the book. They help, and I know some of it myself. But yeah, and as grim as what we've been talking about sounds, this, I feel like in many ways this is my most upbeat book because, which is not raising the bar too high, I understand, but it is a book about wonder as well. And I hope the reader senses that too.
The language, the way you describe this landscape is stunning. You know, the cicadas revving and slowing like sewing machines. Yes, that's exactly what it sounds like. You've got one line that prefaces the story. The moon and ungripped scythe. What is that?
I just thought that would be an image that would actually, you know, where the moon is almost disappearing, just that little curve. Some people might say it's like a hangnail or yeah. fingernail. But I just thought that image by Becky would just kind of trigger a sense that we've got a narrator of these sections who has a sensibility very different from maybe anyone else. Or that's my hope, that she's seeing the world so intensely that she's seeing things in a way that maybe most people can't.
She says things like, it's been perhaps a decade since saplings and sawbriar rise amid broom sedge. I mean, she's quite lyrical, and she's constantly quoting and mentioning the poet Gerard Manley Hopkins, a Victorian-era poet. She puts up a plaque at the park quoting his line, how near at hand it was if they had eyes to see it, because she wants so badly for people to come and see the things she sees in the park. How did you get to Hopkins?
Well, he's always been one of my favorite poets, and I've always admired the intensity of his vision. And you hear it in the sounds. And Becky, in many ways, is trying to emulate his sense of language, the intensity of sounds playing off each other, rhythms. I thought, once again, that would fit her, and he would be a poet that she would admire because he, in a sense, is seeing grace in the natural world.
Was his line, or was it hers, Pentecost of Petrichor?
That's Becky's.
I had to look that up. And it's fabulous. To explain.
Petrichor is the smell in the air, particularly during a drought time, and right before the storm comes or the rain comes, you can smell it coming.
Yes.
And it's just a beautiful smell if you've sensed it. And I thought for Becky, that was to her, that's just such this beautiful moment.
But you slam those phrases up and Hopkins up against the language of Appalachia. It's a gracious plenty, you know, some of the phrases and words that are maybe disappearing.
And that's, in a way, I think this book is in some ways more about language than any book I've written because I'm really trying to stretch the limits in some ways with Becky, but I'm also trying to be true to the language of the region of the Appalachians, or at least the Appalachians I grew up in, and the beauty there, and language that I don't want to disappear. And I think one way we can save some of that language is by putting it in books.
Yeah, writing about it. Well, we haven't talked a lot about the plot because I want readers to have it unfold for them as it did for us. But just a question. You include environmental activists, a long-ago classroom school shooting, which just was chilling. You know, what it might have been like to be in a school like Sandy Hook. What were those references to violence?
Well, I wanted in this book, or maybe not wanted, but the book itself summoned up to, I knew early on that I was going to have two people who had been severely wounded by life. Certainly Becky, who was in the classroom when her, and saw her teacher get shot and in some ways blames herself for that. And Les, who has not been able to understand his ex-wife's depression. And to me, I hope the book feels like two people who are struggling towards some kind of redemption. And I think, to me, the most important thing about the book is I think in many ways they achieve it.
Mm. Well, and the environmental extremist. We don't want to flesh it out too much, but there's one in Becky's past. He could have killed people. And then in modern day, in your storyline, you have somebody who poisons water to get back at someone. So what are you saying?
Well, my first novel was called One Foot in Eden. And I think maybe a lot of my writing is about that. That in a sense, you have this beautiful area, but you also have a kind of place where bad things can happen. One foot's in Eden, but one foot is outside.
We are only human. Ron Rash, thank you as always. Again, his new novel is Above the Waterfall. You're listening to Here and Now.